G'day, welcome back to the Farms Advice podcast, where we talk everything agribusiness to grow and optimize your farm. I'm your host, Jack Creswell, and this week we're doing something a little bit different to the normal schedule. We've called in the big guns and are speaking to Pitt Courtney. You may have seen her on your Sunday's ABC Landline series presenting the next best Aussie farmer and also the updates around the industry. In this episode, we'll dive into her role and how she got there, but also the stories she covered. She's got a story in here that she outlines that's amazing to listen to and just goes against the norm. But in the end, time won, and it also showed the proven practice. The proof is in the pudding, so make sure you listen in to her favorite story. But also listen out to the common traits of people that she has seen to have succeeded in the farming game. We both sort of lost track of time on this one, and we let it roll, which is more important for you to get the benefit out of this. But also, Pip is a really amazing speaker, and I just couldn't stop her with her experience in the industry as the Overseer of Agriculture, which is why we call the episode The Overseer of Agriculture. So enjoy this episode. I really did. Speaking to her is really good to speak to her through the medium of this podcast. So thanks, Pip, for your time. But nonetheless, you'll have to extend your lunchtime break for this one, though. It's pretty long. Also, don't forget to share this one with your mates. It's one not to miss out on. But let's waste no more time and let's get into it. Welcome to the FarmsWise podcast, Pip. Amazing to have you on. You're probably one of the biggest profiles we've had on. And you're like, we watch you religiously every Sunday on the landline over the years. You're bringing the information to the farmers on a Sunday. How's everything going for you? And what's this lockdown done for you currently? Are you locked down at the moment?
Well, I'm based in Brisbane. So yep. We've been pretty lucky compared to my colleagues who live in Sydney and Melbourne. But it has changed how we work. The first few weeks last year, the ABC had us all at home and every single program we needed was on our laptops, which some of them require a lot of grunt and we weren't able to have them before. So now I go up into my dressing room and sit on the floor and put jackets around my head and put my voice down just with a little app on my phone. I can record interviews on Skype and Teams and Zoom and then just send them to the editor, and sometimes the editor's actually working from home. We've had farmers who are really good with their drones who send vision. So it's been an interesting time, because for a while there we weren't allowed to do anything unless it was a day trip. We couldn't travel. Yeah. So last year when we got to do our first trip away to stay away, we went to Dalby and it was like going to Paris.
Totally getting out and able to do something.
Yeah. So there's been a lot of stories about how lockdown has changed things for ag. And we've just been pretty much after the first couple of weeks, just back to normal. But I pretty much work from home now, go in once a week and to do makeup. And then we go out and do the hostings. And then I come home and turn the heater on to 9 million. So nobody in the office can growl at me anymore. And it's quite nice. I've got a beautiful view out my window. So
what more do you need?
Yeah, absolutely.
That's great that the farmers are able to send through the videos by using a drone for your footage for the landline show.
Oh, yeah, my story Sunday week, which is about the grain industry, has got some awesome drone vision supplied by two farmers. I mean, yep. They could work for landline, and our boys have to do a very expensive course and get approved and have a ticket almost like a pilot. And I'm amazed. Some of the farmers are really, really good. They've got a great eye.
Yeah, absolutely. And the technology is there for farmers currently for them to be able to do that. But let's get into it and see who Pip Courtney is and your role within agriculture. What's your connection to Australian ag?
Well, I grew up in the most suburban of settings in Launceston in Tasmania. My dad was a journalist. He couldn't change a light bulb. not practical at all.
Yep.
But my grandma lived on a farm. A couple of aunts did as well. And I always loved visiting and couldn't understand why when I was about seven, my parents wouldn't let me go and live with my grandmother in central Victoria on the farm because they had my brother and my sister. Yep. And I pitched the business case that grandma needed me and they had one of each. Breeding program had worked. They had a boy and a girl and I was access to requirements. I was quite stunned when they said no. But I still remember the day I arrived. It was shearing time and there were sheep in the yards and there was a pony with its head over a gate. There were chickens and sheepdogs. And I just thought this was the most magical place and was very lucky. There was a lovely farm manager there the chief farmhand. He and his wife didn't have kids, so he'd be there at 7 a.m. every morning to take me. And I just spent time with him in the Land Cruiser and asked 9 million questions and just loved it. Went back every year and would have loved to have lived on a farm. But and I studied ag in grade 12 because it was an easy pass. I just loved it, just thought it was fascinating, but I was told you can't do ag at uni because your science skills they're ratchet, basically. And I always wanted to be a journalist. And I never really thought about ag journalism, but the opportunity came up after I'd been at the ABC in Tassie for about 8-9 years to take a job with Landline, and I grabbed it. And that was 1993. And haven't looked back. I love it.
A few years down the track now, and you've got a lot of foundational work like in journalism. You're well known within the industry. But was it when you went to university, you found out that you wanted to become an ag journalist? We just went in there generally to become an ag.
No, I didn't think about ag journalism at all. My dad was a journalist, and I just wanted to be like a lot of farmers or kids. Yep. I just wanted to be the mini female version of Michael Courtney and work in a newspaper. And I was obsessed with news and news coverage. And we had, you know, 4 or 5 newspapers in the house every single day. We listened to radio news all the time and watched every current affairs program, read books about journalism. So it wasn't really a plan. But I had a horse and always was, you know, every spare moment was spent on a horse visiting mates' farms and stuff like that. And it really didn't occur to me. I don't know why. I sort of look back on it and go, ah. But I think I needed that journalism grounding in day-to-day news coverage. And then, you know, the career path is you get your grounding in news, radio news, you do 45-second stories, TV news is a minute 20, minute 30, and then you move into, if you want to, current affairs, which is long form. So I suppose I took the traditional route. And it just all fell into place really by accident. No great planning on my part.
Yeah, well, I think it is quite seamless that long form is what agriculture sort of needs. Landline, like you do get a lot of information out of the show within that time period. You can't have the show running or a little snippet of it for 2 minutes, can you? It wouldn't run too well.
Well, I think that's what the audience likes about the program. When we first started, we didn't have enough staff to run what would be traditionally like 7 or 8 minute stories. So we ran longer stories, and we actually found, and while it was sort of frowned upon by colleagues in other departments who go, oh my God, who's going to watch 17 minutes about the rice industry or meat industry politics or wool politics or even just a general ag topic. We found people not only in the industry would hang in, but other people in ag and also urban audience, because urban viewers have always loved the show, because the brief is find the best farmers in Australia and tell their stories. So no offence to the bottom 50%, but, you know, we want to tell the stories of the innovators, the risk takers, the people who wake up every morning wanting to be better than they were yesterday. And that's what urban people really love. And, yeah, we could do 20-minute stories and people would love it. And, some of them can be quite complex. And I think long form with the beautiful landscapes that we we get to film with our really talented cameraman and with the great characters, it just lends itself to having that longer treatment.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that how you do see different snippets, like it, where livestock, sheep, and then there's something like the rice industry comes on for a story. I think you can really learn something from cross-sector knowledge and maybe even implement something into your own enterprise as a farmer watching the show, watching the leaders, innovators, as you say.
I absolutely agree. And when I'm thinking about a story, particularly if it's about somebody or a business or a particular element of an industry that's been really successful, I think, now, what is the template here for success? What is the approach? What's the model? What's the method? How can I extract the guts of the reasons for success so that if say it's about citrus industry or a citrus producer, how will a sheep producer get something out of that? How will a oyster farmer in Tasmania get something out of that, or a mango producer? And so that I'm looking for templates that are the portable, so anybody can go, nah, what that guy said 3 minutes 50 in, we could do that, even though he's on the other side of the country, completely different in industry and different climate and weather, soil, whatever. And I actually got an email in my second year, 1994, from a panel beater in Sydney who said that he found a story I did on someone in the wool industry incredibly life-changing because he now reassessed his approach to success. And that was just something where I went, well, that's what I want my stories to be.
Yeah, right.
I don't want someone to go, well, I don't grow oranges. Why would I want to watch that story? I want them to go, I'm interested in how you succeed. And so that's what I'm looking for. And there are that we get the occasional snipe where we might do a story on somebody who might be niche.
Yep.
And it really annoys me. And I'll say, oh, what's that got to do with agriculture? And I'll just go, it's the template. Like, it's not, you can have a lot of volume. You can have 20,000 sheep and not be making any money. Or you can be like this person that we've just done a story on who's got 500 and has cut out the middleman, is selling to the best chefs in Australia at a 200% premium to what you're getting. And they're sort of missing the point that it's about niche, finding a niche that suits you for ethical reasons, or what gets you in the soul for what you want to do. But it's about success. And I also think, because some people will give me a ring, and a lot of people in ag and my buddies too, well, Pip, what did you do that for? Oh God, I was falling around laughing about the, emus dash alpacas dash whatever's. And I'll say, I think you might have missed the point. Oh, no, I've got, 10,000 cattle, blah, blah, blah. We're really looking for profitable businesses. I'm not going to do something. I don't want to do stories on people who aren't making money or they've got a business, but you know that it's being backed up by a trust fund
totally.
Income from another area. And I also think that a lot of those niche people that, we might go and film them at farmers markets or something like that. They're actually doing the heavy lifting for the PR in ag. They're actually doing the face-to-face stuff with people who might have a view about whether farmers are cruel to their animals or whether farmers flog their country. But every week at farmers markets, those people that some of my critics might have a crack at me about, I feel that these guys should be sending the big guys a bill. Here's what we've done to raise the profile and the acceptance and the respect for farmers in the community. So rant over.
Yeah, that's actually a great way to put it, that the farmers markets are actually the face of what we're doing behind the scenes. Livestock producer, cropping, no matter how many acres you have, you need to be profitable. And just looking at that with the frameworks, as you said, there's more so why I wanted to get you on, just to see like what have you seen over the years, what sort of frameworks people can implement or they have already in their own enterprise. So have you seen those enterprises having similar frameworks that like are successful and are innovative?
I think it's more an attitude. And I think that attitude is, what is the latest information? I think success is when you say, what was I doing last year? What was I doing 5 years ago? And if you're still doing the same thing, most of the people that I do stories about who are successful are not doing what they did a year ago, 5 years ago, and 10 years ago. That what dad did and grandpa did or the bloke up the road does. That's, you don't just stop. I mean, technology hasn't stopped. My industry hasn't stopped. No industry has stopped. Otherwise, we wouldn't have cars or phones or whatever. So it's the people who are always constantly looking for how can I be 1% more productive with my animals? How can my soils be 10% better next year? How can my tree cover, which will bring in animals, increasing the biodiversity, which means we've got more birds, which means we'll have a lot of the bugs being eaten in the orchard. The people who never stop thinking. And one cattle producer, for example, goes to New Zealand every year to hang out with the top 10 dairy farmers because he figures, I'm a grass farmer first. I have no cattle if I have no grass. So who are the best grass farmers in the Southern Hemisphere? The New Zealand dairy farmers. He's a Queenslander, completely different climate and soils, but he's down there picking their brains. So it's, and as one farmer said to me, I don't want to sit here and go, holy shit, to make myself profitable, I need a 20% increase in my profitability or productivity next year. He said, it's much better if you're doing the 1%ers every year here. And it's because he said, it's in 20 years, if you're doing a 1% here and a 3% there, then your business is always going forward. And when I first started, Zero Till was just starting. Yep. And some of the early adopters, wow. One guy said to me, we hear ourselves, my son and I, being bagged by everybody on the two-way. And the young fellow who'd come back to the farm and said, hey, Dad, why don't we try this? His dad didn't go to the pub for 2 years. So there's a perseverance in the face of criticism, I think, too. That's something that I've noticed that the best farmers do. And, of course, when the drought hit around Parkes where this family were, they had a crop where nobody else did. I think this is in 94, 95, and next year they're holding a field day. So everyone's coming and having a look. So I suppose the benefit of me being an old duck is I've watched that go from being something that was radical, a lot of fence sitters, and then with each successive drought, more people joined the revolution, and now it's not a revolution anymore. But, you know, imagine how far ahead some of the early adopters are if they were 10 years ahead rather than old mate down the road. So, I think it's always looking for that. Where can I get that improvement? And sometimes some of the best people or the most successful people you meet have made that decision that sharing their farm with wildlife.
Yeah.
It might not actually have a column in their accounting, but it makes them feel better about farming and they're protecting their social license further down the track too.
Yeah, definitely. It all sort of ties in. 2 points I got from that is, for farmers, what sort of tips would you give them on finding, being up to date with all the information in searching there? Like, I find farmers are a bit of a lug before they get to the other side. They need to just make that leap. Like the Queensland farmer, just like the flight is at that leap across, literally. What would you say for a farmer to find new information? Just start today or?
Yep. There is so much information out there. Like, I'm drowning in it. Like, I get hundreds of emails a day from all the people, all the organisations that I subscribe to. So I can only imagine that you're busy on the day-to-day stuff. When do you lift your head up and look at the horizon rather than tomorrow or next week? But when do you look to 5 years' time and 10 years' time and look at your grandkid and go, well, what am I doing now to build something for her or him? And one great farmer I met who completely transformed his property in Western Victoria, which was a windswept, treeless, horrible place for sheep and humans, he planted oaks.
Yeah.
And they're for his great-great-great-grandchildren to harvest you know. So I think people who look at the horizon, see what information is out there, and sometimes it's a consultant who will sift through it. If you don't have time, if you're too busy in the day-to-day, find somebody who can sift through the mountain of information that's out there and find what's appropriate for you and find someone that you can work with. And one farmer said to me, he had the lady at the Roma airport said, you, apart from the people in the gas industry, you and your wife have more flights out of here than anyone we know, anybody else in the district. Where are you going? And he said, conferences. And she said, oh, a lot of farmers like to stay home. And he said to me, if my farm falls over because I'm away for a week, what sort of shit show am I running? And so he goes off to conferences. He meets people who have similar ideas. Again, maybe not the same type of farm. And he's just always thinking. So I think if you can absorb the information, go to conferences, meet the best in the business, be inspired by them, meet the Nuffield guy down the road, find good consultants. But I think it's just about saying this place has to be better, more profitable next week, next year, next 5 years, next 10 years, and for the next generations. How do we go about doing that? Because I think if you reverse it, and ask anybody who's successful, are you doing what you did 20 years ago or what your grandpa did? No one would say yes. I don't think so. And if you find someone, let me know and I'll go and do a story on them.
Absolutely. We will pass them on if we come across someone. But something I think about is optimizing rather than scaling out. Like, you don't need another 5,000, 10,000 acres. Are you saying that's something with the innovators? They're looking to maximize what their soil can do. Not flogging the shit out of it, but
yeah,
managing
it. Well, that was the topic of a recent story that I did, and I think we've done a lot of stories on people who their success sometimes is based on scale, buying a farm next door, scaling up. But I think regenerative agriculture is really starting to challenge that mindset that if you've got your soil or you've got 20,000 hectares, if your soil can support more grass and more animals and be last into drought, first out, take use of, and particularly in Queensland, where you can have, you know, spectacularly violent rain events. The regen farmers that I talk to in Queensland say after a couple of years where, you know, they're working on their soil, the big rain events happen and the runoff isn't happening. It's going into their soil and they're banking it. So I think some people are now saying, rather than buying the farm next door, why don't we make this one just ultra productive? Like, pretend we live in England. And I think that's a really great way. And it means you don't get into trouble if suddenly the bank starts charging bigger interest rates and you can really work on your patch of land. So I think that's tip my hat to you. I think that's it's a new and emerging idea. You don't have to, we need to buy a farm up the road. And a lot of successful people I see buy farms not next door, but out of their area to give them some protection if the weather goes bad. But yeah, I feel like, I was there when Zero Till was just starting to get going. And now I feel like I'm doing stories with the early adopters with regenerative agriculture, and it's really exciting. But you only have to look on Twitter, do a story on Regen Ag, and it's like throwing a match and some diesel in there. Because some people get quite defensive, like, what do you mean? Is the implication that I'm not doing the right thing and buy my land and who do you think you are? But I just think, you know, get your defences down, have a look, go to a field day. There could be two ideas out of the 10 that you hear at the field day that you might want to adopt, but there's definitely something there, and I'm seeing it with a lot of the really good farmers.
Yeah, definitely. The proof's in the pudding. And that leads me to my next one, like dealing with the hecklers for those that like disapprove of these new ways of farming or improving what we're doing on farm. With like regenerative agriculture is copping a lot of flack for those starting early. How have you seen like farmers deal with that? You said one went into hiding from the pub for 2 years.
Yeah, that was the zero till back in the 90s. But the people I meet go, we see it every day. Our soil's better. We can see the results. And I think with regenerative ag, you actually see results quite quickly. You don't have to wait. Yeah. It's not like planting trees where you have to wait 20 years to see how tall it gets or 10 years. So I actually find them, they have hides like rhinos. They just go, we're right. You worry about your patch of dirt. I'll worry about mine. And they don't get upset about it at all. And then when people growl at me for, oh, what are you running that story about that person? I just go, look, we're here to do stories about all sorts of different approaches to being excellent. And if you're going to get upset about that, what's going on with you? And so I find that most of them just go, man, we don't care. Let the criticism roll on because we can see it.
Well, the proof's in the pudding and they're going to be more profitable.
Yeah. And particularly in a drought year. And then, you know, we've had lots of rain in at the start of the year in Queensland, and one of the properties that we visited, they were like, well, the water was sheeting off next door, wasn't sheeting off our place. That water is now stored in our soil, just like a bank. You know, we'll be there with the ATM card using that water. But the people who the water was sheeting off into the creek, they were losing topsoil and the water wasn't staying on their place. But I think there was I went to Iowa in the late 90s to do a story on carbon farming over there. And
in the late 90s, very early.
Yes, late 90s. Yeah. And because they were getting a carbon trading market there. And I met this gorgeous old farmer. And the soil in Iowa, I mean, when they dig soil pits, I mean, the profile for the soil is just taller than me.
Yeah.
Tell him about the old ancient soils in Australia and he can't believe it. But he said he loved ploughing. He actually got criticised by his neighbours. A whole heap of them got together and did an intervention and said, our valley is now ugly because you leave your stubble in and it's ruined the patchwork of dark brown and green or yellow or whatever. And he's like, oh, I'm not doing that. And then when they came to visit him, they saw that he had cemented his plough into the front yard and turned it into a garden ornament. And he said he wanted to do that so he'd never be tempted to use it again. But he said he had a light bulb moment when a consultant came to him and said, you really should be going zero till. And he said, oh, no, but I love ploughing. I just love it. He said, what do you love about it? I love the smell. And he said, this guy just looked at him and said, that is the smell of your soil dying. That beautiful smell, it's oxidizing. And he said, you know, he'd been reading all this technical information, he'd had the consultants in, and it wasn't that just one sentence changed his life. And he was getting much better crops, apart from being upset by the visual police in the valley. So I think that I'm really privileged when I get to hear those little light bulb moments, and they become light bulb moments in my sort of journalism journey. I hate that word, but it's late. It's late in the day. Brain's a bit slow. So I love that idea. And I think there's a lot of regen farmers who they must have those little light bulb moments when they go and put the spade in the soil and see the worms and see how friable it is and see what happens after it rains. And I don't know. Yeah. You're doing it. So you must have light bulb moments out there where you go, this is working.
Yeah, we've had a few of those, which is like really good to see, and hopefully a few more once we need to probably adopt a bit more technology just to improve the way we work. But I suppose like the hecklers, hopefully they have a few light bulb moments coming around the corner for them. It's a bit sad to see like that the industry could be much better if they got on board, because if we optimize our patch of dirt and my neighbor and his neighbor are able to, the industry as a whole, we'll be able to reach this $100 billion we're talking about by 2030 or even earlier.
I think it's human nature to be defensive when you think you're doing things really, really well. And then somebody says, well, I think that you should be changing track. They put a lot of effort into be doing things the conventional way. And we get some criticism, that what's wrong with conventional and why are you making that a dirty word? And it's like, we're not making a dirty word. We're just saying, here's another way of doing things. I'm not going to tell anybody how they have to do it. And I'm not saying conventional is not appropriate, but it's just about, here's some ideas. We're going to throw them in the air. I welcome ideas how I could be better at my job. I think they've got to ask why be so defensive.
Yeah, that's it. Hopefully they just hit their light bulb moment like that. Because on the podcast, I'm trying to probably reach those people that aren't listening to the episodes each week, because they're the non-innovators, and I'm just trying to get them on board to start looking for opportunities and to be more transparent about learning new information. It'd be really good to do that. But let's move on. If you weren't a journalist today, Pip, what would you be doing?
Well, I nearly quit journalism after 18 months because I was really bad at it and I wanted to be a wool classer. My step-grandfather had sheep and he showed sheep, and I would just follow him around like a puppy, my grandmother said, just asking questions. Why? Why is that ram better than that one? Why did that one get a blue ribbon and that one got a red one? And so I love sheep and I love the atmosphere of shearing sheds. So I nearly went off and became a wool classer. And if I could have any job in the world, regardless of my skills, I would be a big cat vet.
By the looks of your jumper, you do like your cats, yeah. Don't you?
Yeah. I'd love to. Yeah, it's a bucket list just to touch every big cat in the world.
Well, it's a great bucket list. I don't know how achievable it is. Very hard to catch cats out there.
Yeah, the idea of taking your horse and a horse float and having a dog and just travelling from shed to shed, and then occasionally when I was in the area popping in to see various relatives at Holbrook and Central Victoria, to me the idea of being a wool classer, I'm sure there will be wool classers who can email me or call me and say, you're an idiot, you've totally romanticised and it's not that great a job, but I think when I retire I go and study wool classing just for the hell of it.
Yeah, when we were kids we used to throw the skirting like at each other. How dirty it was, it didn't really matter. The dirtier the better.
And I loved hanging out with the shearers at Smoko. I remember when I was about 6 or 7 and they would pop me up on a bale, and they were just delightful. And I came from a house where there weren't scones and biscuits, and my grandmother had to do morning and afternoon tea Smoko, and she could never repeat. Like, they were pretty tough on
her. How dare she?
And I just loved hanging around with them. And that was back in the day when, they'd turn up and they'd stay. They didn't sort of go home at night. And I just thought they were great. I think my grandmother wasn't too impressed on me back inside. But, yeah, a wool shed is a place I would love to, I would have loved to have some skills there.
Yeah, the lanolins brought you in. The smell of the wool shed's also, quite nice. And if you're growing up in that as a young kid, it does bring that nostalgia back, of course.
And I love, one of my cousins is a wool grower and he's persisted during the downturn. He's in Tasmania and he's just every year his clip gets better and better and better. And I just find it fascinating that a decision you make about breeding or buying in a ram or something that 10 years ago affects you for so long, and it doesn't really come to fruition for 10 years. I just find that really, really fascinating. Because what if you pull the wrong rein with a ram and then you've got to go and fix it? And I just find anything to do with breeding animals and trying to achieve a goal, I find that really fascinating.
Yeah, I think my dream role, if I wasn't doing what I was doing and had time, would be geneticist, knowing the genetics of animals and how each reacts, because that process of being a wool grower, what you do now is going to impact your wool in 5 years' time. Mm. And the same with other livestock.
I remember reading something about they introduced in the early 1900s this really super, super wrinkly sheep, and it stuffed up the industry for like 20 years, and they had to actually breed all those crappy genetics out. So I think on my shelves back there, there's quite a few books on the wool industry.
I might have to borrow them sometime.
You never know. I might be the 70-year-old lady who people go, do I know you from somewhere? What are you? Oh, yeah, I retired ages ago.
You might be interviewed on Landline, how to keep going as a wool classer at 70.
When they do stories about old people in ag.
Very good. But moving on into Landline, the amazing show that it is and what it brings to Australian agriculture, what's a story for you that stands out? What was it and what did it hit the mark with you? How did it hit the mark?
It is Mr. Tree Man of Hamilton in Western Victoria, John Fenton, who died not long ago, which I really look forward to his phone calls when he would ring me up and say, hello, dear girl. And I'd say, oh, John Fenton, how are you? He'd say, how do you know it was me? I'd say, well, nobody else calls me dear girl. And apologies to anybody who's heard this story before, but it really is my favourite. He went to his future father-in-law and said he would like to ask for his daughter's hand in marriage. And he said, you can marry my daughter if you plant trees around your godforsaken farm, because there were about 7 or 8 manky pine trees. And it was just this windswept, horrible, barren property. And he started and he never stopped. He predated land care by about 30 years. He tried forestry trees. He tried planting down fence lines. He did trees with 6 across with 5 to 8 metres of grazing, more trees, so he did strips. He did circles, he did diamonds, he did trees for birds, trees for forestry, trees for windbreaks, and he completely changed the farm. It became like an English park. So he completely transformed the property. In this area, farmers routinely, during bad, cold, wet winters, lost lambs. He had shelter from the trees. His lamb percentages went up. Any bugs that were in the pasture, because he planted all these new trees, there were birds, so he stopped spraying. He had a dam. The next door neighbours were having a wetland drained. He went over and asked the dozer driver to come to his place next, and he said, oh, what do you want me to drain? He said, oh, I want you to build me a wetland. And that's now filled with water birds that bring all these seeds for water plants in their guts. So they've now got birds on the property they hadn't been seen for 50 years.
Amazing.
So he runs more sheep live. So his sheep survival rates were up. He then started to get income from forestry. The bird life came back, which made everybody happy, which I think you've got to look at it and go, this is the best office in the world. You've got to love the views that your farm gives you, I think. And he's now, the property is just amazing. His kids were teased at school. Local farmers used to call him the crazy tree man. And if there was anybody who didn't give a rat's about what anyone thought about him, it was John Fenton. And couldn't have cared less, but he knew he was onto something. And he preserved the bandicoots. And look, it's just the most amazing story about a man who, what he created in 50 years, he created his own microclimate there. And while his son growled at him for not spending money on the yards and other things because it was all going into trees, he's now inherited a property that is highly profitable. And when wool went down, well, the forestry money was great. And after our story went to air, the unis were calling, can we come and visit? Can you, a publisher called, could you write a book about what you've done? And you're never a prophet in your own land. And by telling his story on Landline and having all these people go say to him, what you have done is amazing. And then the locals sort of went, oh, maybe I'll drop.
Maybe he was right.
Maybe he was right. But he was driven, utterly eccentric. And that when you asked before about some of the predictors or the commonalities of people who are successful, some of them are quite, some of them can be eccentric, but that sort of is expressed in a way where they don't care what other people think. So it doesn't bother them at all. And so when I say, oh, you know, I'd say to him, oh, you're brave. And he says, why am I brave? I don't care what old mate down the road thinks. He hasn't got all the beautiful birds. And the bird watching expert who came here and said, this bird has not been seen in this district for 70 years and now it's back. And they had a rule that every evening at sunset, go and sit with the G&T and look out at this beautiful lake that he named after his wife, Lake Sicily. And the deafening noise of all the water birds that are there. And we sort of sat there going, you made this. This is amazing. But it was a profit. He turned an unprofitable property into a profitable one. So that was the guts of it.
Yeah, right. That's actually an amazing story. Trees aren't easy to plant. They're bloody hard on the back. I've done a few days around like university just to cover some fees and everything. It's hard work. So congrats to him. And now the family, the farm lives on.
Yeah, and you put the chopper up and you see all the different shapes that he's experimented with over the years, and the ag department and the forestry department loved having him there because they'd rock up and say, can we try this? Go your hardest. Can we try this shape and or this variety and see what happens there? And I loved watching when we were filming, there was a bird expert and John, and they were walking down what I was talking about before with the strips of grazing with all the trees in between, and all the varieties had been chosen because somebody had said, well, there are little birds that only flit from tree to tree. They don't do these great big long journeys to, could you have something that where they're closer together and can there be this variety because they'll come and they'll like the seeds or the nectar. And the soundo, I look over at the soundo and he's smiling his head off and I went, what are you smiling about? And he's just put the earphones and it was just birds. And you got two old mates and there's ewes and lambs sheltering from the wind. There's green grass everywhere. And, you know, you drive to the property and you're passing these places with barely a tree anywhere, not much grass. And you look at the sheep and you think, who wants to be in Western Victoria in the middle of winter out there? I know where if I was a sheep, I know where I'd rather be. So, and the fact that he had all the numbers to wrap around why this was a good thing to do was fantastic. And then yes. He did produce a book too, which, you know, when I got my copy, I was like, oh, wow, it's all down there. Yeah. So, and he wore a cravat and he had a little Subaru Brumby and he had a tweed jacket. Like, he really was a character out of a BBC Midsummer Murders or something, you know.
Absolutely. And that's the characters that make up Australian agriculture. Something I'm trying to connect the dots to is you can be sustainable but also profitable at the same time. In your work, you'd probably see a lot of kickback at you can't be profitable and sustainable at the same time, but you totally can. And how that's achieved is probably your mindset in connecting the two. Like his true north was probably getting his land back to where it needs to be. Implementing the trees, seeing what works and what doesn't, trial and experimenting. And then unknown to him, he probably did a lot better than he had thought.
Yeah, and to think, like some of the regenerative ag practices that I see, you might get a result in 12 months, but John wasn't going to get a result for 20 years. You know, he had a blank canvas, literally. And he had before photos and after. So we got the photos and went to the area and set up the camera and it was just mind blown. It really was. And the cameraman on that shoot, which was probably back in 95, I think, every now and then he texts me. He says, every now and then that story pops in my head. That guy was a genius, wasn't he? Imagine the fact that, his kids were teased at school. And
yeah, that's the thing, isn't it?
Yeah, but I like your line. I might, steal that. What is your true north? And for him, it was doing right by his father-in-law, who wanted him to do right by his daughter, so that she had a beautiful place to live. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Even better. Yeah. And like, it has turned out quite profitable for the kids moving onto the farm, which is amazing to see and connect those dots. I think it's pretty important for farmers to see those stories. No matter how wild or wacky the farmer is at the time, trying to get that up, and how stupid we look as innovators trying to move on into newer pastures.
And you need the cravat wearing Subaru Brumby driving tweed jacket John Fentons of the world, because then he, what is it, the rising tide floats all boats.
Yep.
So he gets talked about and studied, and university students visit him, and his ideas get disseminated. So he drags everyone else through, or the knowledge is now out there, and people can say, well, does it work? Well, John Fenton's been doing it for 50 years. Here's the, it's dinner time. those early adopters, the fact that they've got these hides of, these thick hides where they don't care what anybody thinks, when they succeed, then that they become leaders, and they drag everybody else through. I like that idea.
Yeah, that's it. And it will only go to show others further down the line. 20 years for the trees to be growing and prosperous, and also 20 years of education for kids coming through the uni systems, or wherever it may land up in TAFE or something, for other farmers to learn from. That's amazing. Thank you for sharing that story with us, Pip. Really good to see what strikes a chord, and then also those sort of, that comes back to the framework of what makes innovative farmers, of course. So for...
I don't think there's enough talked about what a farm's biodiversity, like the joy that John Fenton got showing us his bandicoots. And I've been, you know, where you see the farms for wildlife and various signs on people's properties. And I interviewed a farmer in the New England who helped his dad ring bark the trees on the place, and every roo got shot. And he then replanted the place, and the trees came back because they had a big dieback problem, and they realised that they'd actually mucked up the balance, that once the tree percentage dropped below a certain number, then the bugs could come in and kill the rest of the trees, because there weren't enough trees to support the birds, which kept the bugs under control. So the whole network of various things that a farmer might not assume contribute to that, the health of his property, had gone out of whack. So he's now planting lots of trees, sort of fixed the problem. And at the end of the day, we'd stopped filming, and he said, "Can I take you to my special place?" Yeah, of course. Grabbed a beer each, and it was, sun was setting. And he said, "I just want to show you my kangaroo family." And this little mob of roos of all different ages and joeys and all of that. And he just said, "I come here, this is my quiet place." And my dad wouldn't have shared this place, this farm, with them. And I'm happy to share this property with them, because all the trees and all the wildlife, he now knows, the 50 varieties of birds that he's got. And he just likes sitting there sometimes, just observing the wildlife, whether it's the roos or the birds, and that makes him happy. And I think when you think about the stresses of farming, you've actually potentially got this beautiful place where you can sit back and just enjoy the nature. And again, if there's not a column that your accountant has allocated for that, but I don't know, true north, what's in your heart. So I think, there are plenty of really good farmers I see who've made space for wildlife, actually get a lot in return. It's good for them, and they feel like they're contributing. And we recently filmed on a farm where they're planting trees for koalas. I mean, the farmer nearly burst into tears saying, "I'm doing something." Yeah. And I'm so proud, and I'll be able to tell my grandkids I helped. And so, I just think farmers underestimate what having wildlife on their farm and making room for it can give back to them.
Yeah, definitely. And hopefully, this is not a thing that's going to be lost as we grow and develop, like we can optimize all of our land, but we can also work within what's natural. We're not just going to demolish all the roofs and get rid of all the numbers. And then we can have our beautiful patch of the farm. And it comes back where you want to work is what you like, where we should be making your farm the most beautiful place to be. We're there 24/7.
Yes.
And that's one thing
with farmers, like you can never escape your work.
Yeah.
We have offices we go to and then we come home, whereas you guys, you're there all the time. And why not have it as a beautiful place and show your kids and your grandkids where the animals live and how they all interact, and seeing John Fenton enjoy the bandicoots and the bird life, it's like a natural antidepressant. And then you watch them come and go over the seasons. And yeah, so with all the pressures that farmers are under, I just think wildlife is like a good old natural antidepressant.
Absolutely. And as a farmer, we all need some downtime where we do enjoy ourselves, and then we can reset and go again the next day, the next week, next year. And then we can become better innovators from having that time to be able to reset and see what we can do. Looking at the horizon, like you said previously, it's really important to do as well. And like moving on, what's a piece of farms advice you would give to any budding farmer out there, young or old? What would you tell the 70-year-old wool classes in agriculture?
What would I tell a young farmer? Watch Landline.
Hot tip.
Yeah, hot tip. You heard it here first. I think it's about the mindset. The mindset leads to the accumulation of knowledge. Just every time you get out of bed, make a commitment to yourself. I will be a better farmer, and this will be a better farm. Everything I do every day will lead to that. And I just think that's the best advice for any job. You know, I try and remind myself every Monday, try and be a better journo this week than you were last week. And be a better interviewer, be a better story hunter, be a better writer. Because I think nobody wants to, well, I can't think of a job apart from maybe a surgeon. I can't think of a job where there is no benefit to wanting to be better tomorrow than you were today. So it's not a specific piece of get this sort of tractor or adopt regenerative agriculture. It's just try and be better tomorrow. Because then that opens up, you go to that conference, you might hook into that guy that you saw on Twitter who showed some vision during harvest, jump on a plane and go and visit him, heard about this really cool consultant that someone's using, go and see them, or study a course, or just subscribe to newsletters that might say, well, there's a field day here. I think farming is a bit like my job. It's this constant tsunami of information, which you've got to sift and sift the good from the bad, the new from the news, the purportedly new that's really old, separate that to find the really new, and seek out the best. If you know, my dad always used to say, if you want to be a good writer, you've got to read. You've got to read good books. You've got to know who the great writers are. So he says, start out by reading everything from the crap to the great. And then when you work out with the great, just keep reading. So keep hanging with where the accumulation of the 10 people that we hang with the most. Seek out the best, make them your buddies, get mentors, and be like John Fenton. If you find your true north, whether it's regenerative ag or going to the farmers markets and doing your own label, be like John Fenton. Just do your thing, and the naysayers, well, don't worry about them. And that hopefully you don't stuff it up and the naysayers end up being right, but,
That is key. Don't stuff it up. But that is great farms advice. Thank you for sharing that. Before we wrap it up, you mentioned a few books. Do you have any book recommendations for the bookworms out there?
About agriculture, I think, well, my favourite ag politics one recently was Gabby Chan's one, which is over there, Rusted Off. I did love The Bush by Don Watson. He was Keating's speech writer. Has a very thoughtful look at the bush. Nothing sort of super technical. If I have a look up here. Oh, yes, I do. English Pastoral by James Rebanks, who is a sheep man from the north of England. It's one of the most extraordinary books I have ever read. And I got to interview him when he came out for the Sydney Writers Festival a few years ago. Follow him on Twitter, what he's doing with regenerative ag up there on his in the Lake District is extraordinary. And he's got, by telling the story, that I suppose that would be another thing I would say to a young farmer is I get teased about my love of Twitter. If you told me I couldn't have my Twitter account and I couldn't access it, I would be curled up in a ball with a straitjacket on. I just love it. I'm an information sponge, and I love how the grain growers, like the grain growers, I think in Australia are the preeminent example of how you use Twitter for good. They're there at sowing time talking about sowing rates and fertilizer and machinery and how you fix stuff, and then it's harvest time they're doing the same thing, and they really connect with each other, ask each other questions, and they use it for good, and they have a lot of fun. And James Rebanks, just he decided to use Twitter. He wouldn't show any pictures of himself, it'd just be his sheep and his dogs and the environment. And he's got so many followers around the world who are just fascinated at, like, lambing time. A lamb might die and he says why, and some dude in New York says, oh, mate, that's terrible, and he explains it. And then someone from CNN turned up to do a story on him that goes to air in the States. And I think the New York Times sent their ballet reporter to do a story on him. And then a publisher sees the story, reads that story, and he's asked to write a book. And if he is like John Fenton, he's doing his thing. He was told at school that only dumb kids did ag. And it's about farming as a community. It's about him and his herd, which sheep, which the Vikings had. It's an extraordinary book. And it's about how important farmers are. And follow him on Twitter. He generates lots of fantastic conversations about what's going on in ag in the UK, about whether farmers are appreciated or not, how they fit into the EU. James Rebanks. And he's got another book coming out soon. One of the most thoughtful writers about agriculture and why it's important and where it's going. Every sentence I'd be like, oh, this guy is a better writer than me. Better writer than anyone.
Yeah, it's annoying, isn't it?
I would kill to have written that sentence. It's just the way he uses the English language. It's like watching Thorpey swim or something like that. But
Great.
If you don't like it, I don't want to be their friend, basically.
Well, great. Thank you very much for those recommendations. We'll try find his Twitter and we'll tag it in so people can have a look what's going on as well. And also yours later down the track.
There's Gabby's new one, Why You Should Give About Farming. She is one of the most thoughtful writers about agriculture and ag politics in Australia.
I think that's a bit of a gap for Australia. I think we read like a lot of books about the UK, America, Canada, as such like that. I think like John Fenton himself, he wrote his book about what he did. And I think Australia is like sort of wanting, crying out for Aussie-made books that relates directly to our agriculture. It will go a long way to improving us if we're reading what's going on within our shores as well.
Yeah, look, I think there's a lot of books out there. It's just about finding the time. As I said, I find there's a tsunami of information there, and there's so many books that you could read. And I think, this is my next one. And, I think this is a really important discussion, and people, if you want to be able to, because I think one of the big threats agriculture is facing is social license and anyone in animal agriculture. Like, hello, what are you doing to think about how you're going to deal with it? And I just think you can't just say, my business is legal and I'm just going to keep doing it. You've got to be aware of what society's up to and how important social media is in terms of, and I don't mean important good, I just mean the influence of social media in changing or in influencing how people who didn't give a thought to how pork or chicken was raised or didn't even know what the live export trade was, but because other people are ahead of the game and they're the anti-forces, I do see farmers and their representative groups being very flat-footed in dealing with that. So that's why I think reading something like Gabby and something like James Rebanks is important.
Yeah, definitely. Going outside the
conversation. Yeah, be involved in that conversation because Ag Force is not going to fix your problems. New South Wales farmers isn't going to fix it. It's a full court press with everybody being involved.
Yeah, definitely. And you can move a lot quicker if you increase your own knowledge as an individual farmer, farming family, farming group.
Yeah.
Well, we'll start to wrap it up there. I'm not sure if you're aware, we usually run 30 to 40 minute episodes, but I didn't want to stop the value that you bring to the table with your experience within on Landline as a journalist within Australian agriculture. I see you having a really big impact on the industry. And hopefully you see it that way as a bit of a profile within agriculture.
Well, we have a big impact, I think, because farmers, the farmers we approach are very generous and they say, yes, you can come and annoy me for a day where I won't get any work done while you film. So I'm always extremely grateful to those because Australian farmers are very self-deprecating. And an American ag journalist once said to me, don't know how you get any work done in Australia. Because I said, oh, they'll always say, oh, the guy at the road's doing something better than me. And you've got to work sometimes quite hard for them to come on because they don't like putting their head up and, you know, they're a bit reluctant to say, well, this is what I'm doing and I think this is the best way. And my ag journo mate in America said, oh, they knock our door down. They'll ring up and say, you should do a story on me because I'm really great. I said, that doesn't happen in Australia.
That's totally different in Australia. Even for the podcast, yeah. Like, I get knocked back, but I don't want to do that.
Yeah, I don't want to put my head up. Don't want anybody thinking I've got a big head. And it's like, but sharing information leads to conversations and that is so valuable. And so I'm really grateful to all those wonderful farmers who say, yes, Pip, come bring the crew. I'm happy to talk about what we're doing. And because, you know, sometimes you're giving a heads up to somebody else in your industry about why you are successful. But they're very generous with their information and their time because having a landline crew, it's time consuming.
Yeah, I bet it is. The podcast for myself is pretty time consuming. And then the landline is next level production for it as well.
Yeah. Although I do have a plea if farmers could be just a little bit better with their directions. We get lost.
You got lost a few times then.
And one guy in WA went to his sheep property, and as we're driving down and I'm reading out the instructions to the camera crew, and I'm going, so we go left at the big red the big tree, right at the green water tank, and the cameraman's driving, he said, there's a bloody street name for every road we're going down. And I'm like, yeah, okay, left at the Wiggly Bridge, and yeah. And we zoom straight past his place, and there are two giant cement merinos as tall as a house either side of his gate. He didn't tell us that.
Of course not. That'd be too easy.
The directions. So now I have to say, pretend you're talking to a very thick 10-year-old and give me the directions, and I go, no. I'm dumb. I'm just like an 8-year-old. I'm writing it down. So, yeah. Please have a mud map that you can email us.
Get someone else to check over the map before it's passed on to Landline.
Yeah.
Great. Thank you, Bip.
So lost time is when we can't film time.
Yeah, absolutely. You're losing out on a bit more there. Optimising your film time, of course. Good to see. for the Farms Advice podcast, like yourself, who else would you like to hear on the podcast and why?
I thought about that before and I had an answer. I would like to go to the biggest grain grower in Australia's property at harvest. Like whoever's got the most headers going at one time, I'd like to hang for 2 days to show people it's night and day, the skills involved, who's feeding them, when do they sleep, and how do you manage all that? That's what I would love to do a story on. That's always been. And if I could have a chance to go and hang with, go to a cattle station in the north that takes a lot of young kids, like in their gap year, to be there at the start of when they turn up, and they might have just finished school and living at home or living in a boarding school, be there for a week at the start, a week in the middle, and then the last week at the end of season. I would love to see that progression of how a kid who's, you know, goes to school in Brisbane and has grown up in Brisbane goes and does his gap year. But, and I think if I could, Trevor Lees, who runs Australian Country Choice, he's my next dream interview, which I'm working on.
Okay, it's a race.
It's
no, that's so great.
Started with one property and then has a whole series and works a fully integrated supply chain, supplying coals, and just started with one property and a phone call.
That's where it all starts. One property, optimize the first one, get on to the next one.
Yeah. You know, it's feedlots, abattoir, exports. Just an amazing businessman. And I love sitting down with people who've got that great business brain, trying to tease out those, not a whole chapter about business management, but those great one-liners that really distill what is the essence about what makes them successful. And for some of them, it's about empowering their staff. For others, it's about making sure the staff are part of the journey and or part of the, and they know what the vision is and we're all heading in the same direction. And there's a thing that happens about once every 3 years. I'll be leaving a location and I'll think, well, when the ABC gives me the bullet one day, I want to work for this person. I don't care what job, but they're just so inspiring with their business. And maybe I'll be, I don't know, answering the phone or making smoko, but they're so inspiring. You just want to be in their world, and whatever train that they're on, that everybody else is on, I want to be on that train as well. So I've got about four of those people. So when the ABC gives me a bullet, I'll be ringing them saying, can I have a job? I'll do anything.
Even wall classing. That's great to see. And it is pretty invigorating for those working under those innovators as part of the team, heading towards their true north.
So I think, I don't know in your life, but to a young farmer, I would say find that mentor that you get, that gets where you want to go. And sometimes you don't even know where you want to go, but I've had great mentors in my early years and still, you know, tap into, bring someone, say, I'm really stuck with this script. The structure's just all wrong and I don't know how to, and they'll give you a hand. And so I think finding mentors, sometimes outside your family, is important.
Definitely I advise outside the family.
Yeah.
But that's it. Thank you very much, Pip. I couldn't be happier to have you come onto the podcast and share your knowledge of the industries, the cross-sector learning that you've had, and hopefully others can find that light bulb moment in what they find for their own farm or just within Australian agriculture. So thank you very much
for coming on the show. I hope I've added some value because, as I said, I know a little bit about a lot of things. But, I'm no expert on growing grain or sheep or wool or anything, but I have been very privileged to hang with some of the best in the country. So,
absolutely. You're more of an overseer of agriculture. You've seen what's happening here and there. very lucky to have the job that you do, that you can go out there and see what you do see, and report the stories for us to watch on the Sunday. Looking forward to the next Sunday episode coming up. But for anyone that wants to reach out to you, is the best place to find you on Twitter?
Yeah, my email address is there, and and I think I've got on my bio thing, you know, send me a story tip, and I love it when farmers ring up and say, I think this is a story. Breaks my heart when I have to say, yeah, no, but thanks for calling. But yeah, there's a bazillion stories out there, and never have any trouble finding them. So yeah, find me on Twitter and email away and join Twitter. And one little thing, my favourite Australian tweeter is Shane Callis and his wife in South Australia.
Yep.
They fit totally into the category. I don't know if you follow them or not, but they fit in the category of people who are doing the heavy lifting for ag's reputation with city people. And they have they're running their sheep and replanting a rundown farm in South Australia. And they have their sheep dogs and their Anatolian shepherd who looks after the sheep. And they report all through lambing season about how many have been born today, and is Abla the Anatolian shepherd chasing more foxes. And it is one of the best Twitter accounts you'll ever find. And every farmer who meets Shane and Joe should buy them a beer and say thank you for the positive presentation of agriculture in terms of treating their animals and treating their land. Thank you for what you're doing, because all your followers on Twitter are thinking better of ag and farmers as a result. So if you follow three people on Twitter, James Rebanks, he's at Herdy Shepherd, I think, and Shane and Joe, and then me, please.
The big three for Australian agriculture. Start learning today, of course.
And if you don't like Twitter, it's just the best place to be. You can unfollow anybody who gives you the shits or you find boring. And there's heaps of information, heaps of beautiful photos, heaps of good people there. And there are farmers you can connect with around the world.
Yeah, definitely. And you'll find some hecklers on there, no doubt. But don't worry about them. Pass them to the side. Thank you very much, Pip.
I have my little mental cravat of John Fenton. So when the hecklers start, I just go, what would John Fenton do? And he'd go,
Doesn't matter.
Yeah. But thank you.
No worries. Thank you, Pip.
Sorry about all cats.
That's all right. We had a midway streaker on the show. Thanks. Thank you for listening to the amazing episode with Pip Courtney and myself. She is the most down-to-earth person and really loves what she does. She brings the best innovators and optimizers of Australian agriculture to light each week, which is really important so that we can all feel inspired and motivated as an industry to level up. If we're to see successful stories on the series, then it should go to inspire others to do good as well. I hope that you were able to get something out of this episode. It was a marathon, but well worth it. Tell me what you thought of it in an Apple Podcast and review, but possibly even 5 stars. That would be amazing, so that we can help reach more farmers right across Australia. It doesn't take 1 minute. But until then, next Tuesday, keep on farming.